Well, hello, y'all knuckleheads. It's I, your Papa Jaffe. Good to see you. Welcome to episode 2 of My Brain is Leaking. I think I'm going to stick with that title. We'll see. This is the podcast that is for members exclusively. This is a podcast where I talk about some war stories from working in video games, where I talk about just more kind of less news of the day and more about games and game culture in general. Okay, so buckle up, my friends. Here's what we got this episode. I got to show you this really cool new game in a second. Not because it's a new game. I just said I'm not talking about news and new games, but this is a little bit different because it deals with a really interesting psychological phenomenon that I think will be evergreen regardless of when you listen to this. But after that, we will dive into the Kojima documentary that this week is debuting on Hulu and or Disney Plus, depending. I guess I'll give my review, but we'll also just sort of discuss the whole idea of myth building in general, specifically in video games, pop culture. Then we'll do a couple of more worst days in the video game business stories. Next week, I promise I'll do some happy stories, but I want to get a couple of twisted metal rough ones in there. And then we'll wrap it up with some questions from members. So the first thing I want to tell you, though, is about this game. This came across my radar. I want to say it was from one of our longtime God of War supporters and creator of Day One Patch Kids, Rotten Tanuki. I could be wrong on that. If I am, let me know. This is a game called Squad 51 versus the Flying Saucers. I'm going to let the trailer play as we chat a little bit because I want to tell you about this word. The word is, and I'm probably going to say it wrong, anemoia. Anemoia. Come on now. The definition is nostalgia for a time you've never known. And it's a relatively recent word. I think it was coined in like 2019, 2018. So it hadn't been around that long. But it's a word that resonates with me specifically as it relates to the 40s and 50s. And there are explanations for why people have this anemoia, which is basically sometimes it's related to what you grew up with as a little kid that your parents were kind of talking about, listening to in the car, watching on television. It's basically is still nostalgia, but it's an almost like hyperinflated version of nostalgia that the idea is the further you, this is at least according to, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, the further you go back into the past, the more idealized the presentation of that past tends to be because, you know, if you are nostalgic for a year ago, you still have the memory sense of like, yeah, I know I'm nostalgic, but I'm not an idiot. I know that wasn't as idyllic as it seems. Well, when you start getting real far back, aka places, times you didn't exist in because you weren't born yet, you end up having an amplified version of that nostalgia. But what's really interesting about it is because you don't have any real life experience with that time period, you aren't able to counteract the nostalgia like you normally would with logic and remembrance of going, well, it wasn't perfect. I'm just kind of remembering the good stuff, or I'm remembering it through a beautiful rose-tinted lens. Because you don't have those sort of memory guardrails, your brain is allowed to really, even though intellectually you know it's crazy, go off the rails with feeling that it must have just been absolutely perfect. So according to at least some of the articles I've looked at about this, if you have nostalgia for a time that you didn't live in, it's actually more powerful than normal nostalgia because it's easier to trick your brain into thinking that that time really was perfect. And it's amazing. There are people on the internet that, you know, there's one guy I follow on Instagram who's obsessed with the 40s and everything he wears and dresses. And it's like he's, you know, living in Indiana Jones time. And there's a girl who's in her early 20s. I think she's in college and she's obsessed with the 80s and she dresses, you know, like it's the goddamn 80s all the time. God dang 80s. What am I making a PG fucking thing? You know what I'm saying? It's really weird, but it's really cool. And I have it. I have it. I have this disease, I suppose. So for me, it's always been the 40s. It's always been the 50s, specifically 50s horror and fantasy in sci-fi. The idea of like the creature features of like Frankenstein and Dracula from, you know, the late 30s, early 40s, you know, War of the Worlds, all the sort of matinee movies. And it's not even that I watch these and like them. Because most of them I don't. Like, I love Godzilla as an idea, and I love Godzilla as a character. No, I've not seen the new one yet. Godzilla Zero, or whatever it's called. But I will. Minus One, whatever the thing it's called. But it's that there's something about this time period that just feels incredibly innocent and fun and safe to me, right? And I'm sure because my dad and mom grew up roughly in that time period. And so a lot of it's that. A lot of it is I was obsessed with movies as a kid, which meant I was obsessed with movie makers as a kid. And the movie makers when I was a kid were the kids that were coming of age in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. And in that, I guess, you know, I was nostalgic for their childhoods because I read about them and saw images of them for so much. Anyway, I bring it up because obviously the images on your screen, this is a standard shooter. There's not much special about it in regard. It's not bad. It's pretty good. It's not very long. I haven't finished it yet, but I think it's like you can finish it in an hour and a half or so. But it is all done, I'm assuming, with actual models and some stock footage of the backgrounds. I don't think this is CG made to look like an old 50s sci-fi alien invasion movie. I think these are real props in someone's office, home, studio, whatever. Could be wrong. And then obviously they shot some live action and stuff like that. I'll be streaming this on the show soon. We'll play it together. But I just wanted to share it because I think, A, it's one of the coolest looking games and coolest looking shoot 'em ups I've ever seen. But also because I just, you know, I just love this type of world. And you can almost tell when you look at the images here where it's people trying to convey, it's, you know, a movie back in the day, like that when it gets into the acting. They have a bunch of filters over it, but it can't capture it because it's all done with like green screen and stuff like that. But it's the game itself looks very authentic. And then they've got all the talking of the characters over the game while you're playing and stuff. So you hear the drama. It feels like an old radio drama. It's quite cool. And then of course the thing you may have already seen, which is just the piece de resistance. I can't even say it. The big cool thing. How about that? Is that, look at that. Look at that. Is that the final boss monster? I don't know, but it's totally a man in a suit busting out that you got to shoot. I don't know if he's actually a man in a suit, but it harkens back. But anyway, Squad 51 versus the Flying Saucers. It may not be your cup of tea. I'm not usually a shooter guy, but my God, the world, the art, the way they made this game is delightful to me. And it totally tickles my sense of Animoia. And but I mean, I certainly think, you ever see that Mad TV episode where it was like a Johnny Rockets 50s diner? And you know, if you've ever been to those, it's the idyllic version of that time. And on Mad TV, it was this white couple that went to a Johnny Rockets style thing, but with their black friends. And it was a literal interpretation of the 50s. So it was like racist and they couldn't sit together and black people had to sit at the counter. They couldn't sit at the counter. And it was like, what, you know, but it was set in modern times and both the white and the black family were like, what the fuck is going on? But the people in the cafe were totally committed to the bit. It was awesome. But anyway, so I don't imagine I would actually genuinely enjoy going back to those times, but they'd be kind of fun to visit. You ever see the movie Matinee with John Goodman and, believe it or not, little Corey Barlog. Corey Barlog of Sony Santa Monica and God of War director fame is actually in that movie, and not as a blink and you miss him background character. He's got like lines. He's got like, he's certainly not a co-star. He's not in it that much, but out of a 90-minute movie, he's probably got about 4 minutes of screen time. It's pretty cool, but it's very much about the 50s and these kind of, you know, charlatan producers, movie producers that went from town to town before there was the massive distribution of the current studios, and they would put buzzers in seats and they would release, you know, smells into the theater and, you know, really be this kind of showman idea. It's a really fun movie. Joe Dante directed it. And again, there's a bonus, Corey's in it. All right. I just wanted to share that with you. Squad 51 versus the Flying Saucers. Let's get to the first topic of the day, which is the Hideo Kojima documentary that has just come out. It came out before in theaters and whatnot, and they also premiered it. Sony did a premiere when it first came out at, I think it was the Tribeca Film Festival, and Kojima was there in New York, did a Q&A. It was a big deal, but I think this is the first time it's really been made available wide. It just came out. I watched it. I guess what you really want to know is,
did you like it?
And I'll tell you right now. The Hideo Kojima documentary is out on Hulu and Disney Plus right now, at least in America. It is called Hideo Kojima, Connecting Worlds. It is an interesting thing. I don't want to really call it a documentary because it's not a documentary. What you will find very quickly is this is a commercial for Death Stranding. It's not presented that way, unlike, say, Grounded 2, the recently released documentary about The Last of Us Part 2, or Raising Kratos from 2018's God of War. Those make it very clear these are done by Sony, and they are there to promote the title and maybe even an HR push to get people to join the studios and the various groups that make the games. And I don't know who funded this. I know at the beginning is sort of the PlayStation Productions logo that now we see in front of The Last of Us TV show and the Twisted Metal TV series. They could just be about the distribution. This may have been a self-funded thing, but it sure doesn't feel like it. Okay, so I'm a little bummed by the fact that I did think we were getting a more traditional documentary about this guy, the you know, warts and the amazing things. And instead, we pretty much got a puff piece, which is really what this is, especially a puff piece that tries to make you buy Death Stranding. Doesn't mean I didn't like it. There was some stuff I really liked about what the documentary offered or what the film offered. And I want to talk about those. But let's get the stuff that I really did not like out of the way first. And then we'll talk about what I did like. And then I'll tell you some questions I have after watching it. And then I'll give you my rating for what it's worth. And I'll also talk about myth building and sacred cows in media as it relates to this and various experiences I've had as a fan and a creator of video games and media in general. So the stuff that really irks me in all of these Sony ads, which is, like I said, what they are, is the just horseshit, flowery presentation of these people and the process as being some kind of artistic battle. And these characters, in this case, Kojima specifically, are on the front lines of pushing the art form and blah, blah, blah. Now, maybe that's true, and maybe there is a documentary to be made about that as it relates to Kojima, but this ain't the one. This is filled with slow motion shots of Kojima walking, pondering, sitting down in slow motion in a movie theater to watch a film that just happens to be no one else is in the theater. I'm not saying that it's not aiming for sort of a visual poetry in that. I don't think they're trying to convince you that when Kojima goes to the movies, no one else shows up because he's so important and they want to leave him alone. But there, you know, all of these shots try to convey a sense of here is a man lost in a very big brain that we mere mortals are simply not capable of understanding, but at least we can watch as the man ponders the questions of the universe. And then when you take those slow motion, very nicely shot images of him wandering about in Tokyo or somewhere in Japan, and then you play this kind of music, and I'd love to show you this stuff, but Sony, you know, they'll hit you with a copyright. At least me, they will. They did recently, and it's annoying, different story. But if you pair those slow motion shots with this music that is very ethereal and, oh, you know, very, you know, trancy and just very evocative of these ideas of like something important is going on, something's happening, you know, you're bearing witness to something really special. That's bad enough, right? But then when you take a lot of these talking head sound clips, which is what they've got the great film director George Miller, they've got Grimes, the singer, they've got Churches, the band, they've got a couple people, they've got video game people, they got Mikami is in there from RE4 and Tango Gameworks, you know, and then they've got a couple of people, I'm like, who the fuck is this person? There's some guy who's talking about art and stuff, and I'm just like, who? Not like fine art, but like, he's like sitting by Legos, and he's has this affected accent, and it says he's a writer director. I'm like, I don't know what he's done, but anyway, full of himself, full of shit. At least he comes off that way. Maybe he's not. But the point is, you've got these slow, beautiful shots of Kojima wandering. You've got the ethereal music. And then you've got these talking points from these people. And the talking points are so tropey and benign and vapid to be just utterly useless. You could plug in almost anybody that they're talking about. It's the standard, oh my God, he's such a genius line that you've seen in documentaries, or should I say press-based documentaries, ad nauseum for years, okay? A couple of my favorites were, it might have been Churches, the band. One of the guys in the band is like, yeah, I don't know when he sleeps. I don't think he sleeps, really. Really? It's just shit like that. Just that myth-making of like, he doesn't sleep. He's just always thinking. He's always thinking. There's no value in sharing that information unless there literally is part of the documentary that says this is a guy who is struggling with insomnia. And in that, these are where some of these interesting visions and characters like Psycho Mantis and Die Hardman and whatnot have come from. But short of that, it's just a bunch of pablum crap. Another one that I just, it drives me crazy. And this one may drive me crazy more because I've been part of this. Like whenever Sony would come around and shoot documentaries and stuff, it would be like, okay, Jaffe, no, go sit with this guy on the team and you guys look at the monitor and act like you're discussing something. And Jaffe, you point at it and then they'll you know, respond or nod or whatever. This documentary is filled with shots like that. And more importantly, shots where we actually can hear the dialogue between Kojima and his teammates, and they really come across more like short order cooks. It's like anything he says, and it's not like he's saying, oh my God, guys, I was walking in slow motion today and I had an idea of how to merge philosophical musings with gameplay that actually results in the player having a better understanding of the philosophy that we're trying to get across than even explaining it to them, you know, in the simplest of sentences. And they're like, oh, that merits that response. But instead, what they're responding to is, I think this area should be able to be seen better, or I think the car should be able to make the jump across here, and maybe we can do something about that. Oh, what a clever idea, Kojima. You think people should be able to see more into the little BB baby's little, you know, capsule? Oh my God, the genius has arrived. It's annoying as shit, okay? Because it's horse shit. You know it's horse shit. And it's annoying because you know it. The other thing is, like, just my own experience. Like, I remember we did this documentary called Twisted Metal, The Dark Past, and it went on Twisted Metal head on. And in it, there was a shot of Scott Campbell, the co-creator and co-director of Twisted Metal. And he's standing on this desk looking at this massive printout. I guess this is back in the day where printouts were still kind of, you printed it out and it was all attached. You had to kind of pull the papers apart. And it went from, like, you know, 8 feet to the floor. Like almost like a kingly scroll that had been unscrolled. And I remember the text on the screen was, the team receives Jaffe's change demands or change list or something like that. And rightly so, when at the time they were called Incog, they saw it, they sent it back and said, you have to change that. We're not, you know, we're not like cooks that just wait around for Jaffe to tell us what to do. We're part of this process as well. It's very similar here, but instead of the documentary crew and the editors going, oh yeah, we know, we just didn't know. We thought it was more dramatic. We'll change it. And in Twisted Metal's case, they did. And they reflected a more honest approach to how games get made and how our game got made. But in this documentary, there are literally parts where, you know, there's a part where Kojima is talking about something about, I don't even fucking remember at this point, but it was just like, oh, I'd like this to be over here like this. And he draws it in a notebook and he gives it to a guy who's sitting next to him, like eagerly awaiting, you know, Moses to come down from the mountains with the Ten Commandments. And he takes it and then he turns to his desk and it's like, I'm going to start working on it right away. And it's just, it's dumb and it's disrespectful to the process. And I hate it. Another one was like he goes into this bookstore and over that you hear one of the teammates saying, Kojima, he reads a lot and he reads a lot of books and novels and whatever. And then it's like he absorbs them. And from that absorption, he creates new worlds. And it's like that could apply to the greatest creative mind that's ever walked planet Earth. Or that could apply to a third grader who's just read a Superman comic and now he goes to draw his own comic book and it's heavily inspired by what he just read 10 minutes ago. Everybody who does creative work, good or bad creative work, is inspired by what they bring into themselves by other medium. It's not a flag that one waves that says, because I do that, my art is great. That's just, you're defining the process and presenting it in such a way that makes it sound like it's special, but it's just a normal thing that any creative does. Now, again, I'm going to get to some good stuff, because this documentary made me like Kojima more, and it made me become much more interested in the actual games he makes. So this is not a bash. It's a bash of the documentary, quote documentary. It is not a bash of the man. It actually makes him more appealing than I think he's ever been. And I've met the guy, and the guy's super nice in real life. I've only met him once, but it's not like he needed a makeover for his image. But the documentary falls, but he doesn't. But there's a few more I got to tell you that just bug me. Time code it, so you can skip if you're tired of hearing me complain. I don't blame you, but this is a sore spot for me. You know, one of it is when they talk about the risk that Kojima takes, the risk. It's, you know, you got to be bold, and you've got to be the warrior going out to slay the dragon of the unknown in the creative arts. And that's what makes him important and special. One guy says, it might have been George Miller. He says, you can't give the audience what they want all the time. You also have to make them understand that sometimes they want something they don't know. Perfectly valid, correct, important thing to say about creation. Miller says the risk is that people just don't accept it, meaning the risk that you take in doing that is people won't accept it. He says it's too radical in some way. But of course, the upside is that you change the medium you're working in. And that's why his work is so important. And I'm like, why? I'm not saying his work's not important. I'm not saying he's not a creator in video games that is to be lauded and respected and spotlighted in a documentary. If you're going to be a documentary and you're going to tell me that his work is so important, and then you're not going to explain why, I'm not saying it's not, but I've played most of his games. I can cite many, many, many other games that were a lot more important to the medium. I don't think Metal Gear Solid has really influenced all that much compared to a game like Doom or Mario 64 or some of the Blizzard early games. I don't know why it's allowed or why it's accepted to say something like that. And then if you're making a documentary, you just leave that. Don't you want some details on that? I guess not, because it's not really a documentary, right? But yeah, this idea that he's taking these risks, you know, he's not taking any risk. He's Hideo Kojima. He might be taking an ego risk, but his game is funded by Sony and now Microsoft, and any other publisher would line up. The guy could go get a job anywhere. The risk is, like, I'm following this woman on Kickstarter and Twitter, and she's making a game called Spilled. It's a one-woman band. She works in a grocery store part-time to fund her life, where she lives on a little one-woman boat that she paddles around or engines around. I don't know how it gets where it's going. And she lives on that, and she makes the video game in her spare time. That's somebody taking a goddamn risk. It's like, if this doesn't work, I mean, she's not going to die. But at least her situation is not like, oh, if Sony rejects me and the game fails, I guess I'll have to go to Microsoft. I mean, just be honest with your damn customers, with your consumers, with your audience. It's stupid. There's a lot of stuff like that. It's like, oh, he can see the whole picture. Yes, because he's the director. That's the job. The job of the director of Drawn to Death, which is a game a lot of people come at me and say, that was a shit game, Jeffy. You have no right to criticize anything. Or the director of Death Stranding, a beautifully reviewed game. The job, regardless of the outcome, is your job is to keep the picture in your mind of everything. That's what you do. So you can give people decisions so they can get their work done. It's not romantic. It's not poetic. It's just a practical part of what the job of a director on a movie or a video game or a Broadway play is. The other thing I'll say is, if you're over the age of 12 and you liked this documentary a lot, here's my question for you. Do you think it's a me issue where I'm really sensitive to this shit because I came up believing in the horse shit, and it's almost like being deprogrammed from a cult? You know, it took me a long time in my early adulthood to realize that all that shit I had been fed by the Hollywood PR machine was utter horseshit meant to take money from my parents and put it into the bank accounts of the studios. And so when I came out of that, I'm obviously worked my way through it, and now I'm very suspicious of it, and I'm always on the lookout for it, not consciously, but when I see it, it's really obnoxious. But maybe people like you, if you are over 12, and I hope you are if you're listening to this, maybe you're like, no, we know it's fantasy, Jaffe. We don't believe it. as a real thing, it's just kind of fun to believe. It's a fun fantasy. And so that, this is an epiphany I had recently. So I my brother likes this show on Netflix. I want to say it's called Heartbreakers, I think. And I got him for his birthday this little display, diorama of the characters, right? And it's been sitting on my kitchen counter for 3 months because I have ADD and I haven't had a chance to mail it yet. And I was getting it ready to mail, and I think I was making lunch or something, and I glanced at the title of the show that's printed on the box that says Heartbreakers. And it was written normally, but it was just certain letters were a little bit off. And I just thought that was so charming. Or when I look at a piece of comic book art or action art or concept art in general by someone that really moves me or excites me or whatever, it's me taking in the product as a consumer only without any knowledge of behind the scenes, right? And so in my mind, it must be so fun to be able to be an artist who can draw those cool things. And I'm sure there's a part of it that is. But there's also a big part of it that is incredibly hard. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of practice, a lot of frustration. And maybe the right answer is, as long as you approach this stuff from a perspective of you're in on the joke too. You know Kojima's just this guy. And you know he's not this genius they're trying to make him out to be. It's just, yeah, it's fun to pretend. It's fun to believe that, you know, after I come home from my day of work where reality hits me square in the face, it's fun to believe there's this world where these sorts of things and people and ideas and this sort of flowery sense of the world with the slow motion shots and whatnot is a real thing. And in that case, I think if you know what you're getting into, I think that's cool. And that's what I'm wondering. If you watched this and you enjoyed it, is that why? Or did you watch it and you actually bought this? Or you bought the Santa Monica story, how they sold it to you in Raising Kratos, or Grounded 2 with Last of Us Part 2? Because if it's the latter, I have to ask, how do you not recognize that you're being sold to and lied to, basically? And it sounds like I hated this documentary, and I did. But Kojima, as I said, comes off great in this documentary and his game. This documentary has made me want to play Death Stranding. I've already played it for about 4 hours when it first came out, or a few months after, and I liked it. It was a little slow. But Kojima talks about his motivations, and I've heard him talk about it in the press before, but having this kind of unedited moment to talk about that sense of people are more isolated, and I really wanted to do something that allowed people to have a sense of connection. And especially with COVID, that this was released right around that time, it really was cool for me as an audience member to hear how that brought people together. It's not like they didn't. If you have Death Stranding, you have the internet, probably. It's not like you couldn't have gone online and talked to people, but just that kind of sense of, oh, maybe some people got some peace from their loneliness during COVID or any time in life, because this was clearly a game about that. Guillermo del Toro, the director, was talking, and he said this, which I really, really liked, and I think it applies. He says, the dynamics are exactly the opposite of Death Stranding of every other video game. You are taught virtues that seem impossible in gaming. Patience, empathy, solidarity. Now, I'm pretty empathetic and I'm down with solidarity. I don't have a lot of patience. And I was like, oh, maybe I really do need, not that I think most games deserve my patience, because it's like, you're here to entertain me. I gave you my money. What the fuck has taken so long? But in the case of, if that's the intention and there's a meta to it, there's a reason it starts really slow burn besides just arty farty reasons, I'm interested. So he says, you're taught virtues that seem impossible in gaming. Patience, empathy, solidarity. It's the only game I've played where I thought I was a better person at the end of the game. Now that lands with me, because I'm like, what a neat thing for a game to be able to do. I've never played a game that's made me feel that way. And I'm much more motivated to play this now. Troy Baker, the great Troy Baker, he's been on our show, the voice actor who voices, I don't know the name, one of the characters in the game. I think he's the bad guy who goes against Sam Bridges at a point. Here's what he says. This is great. He says, there's something that the game could do that no show, no movie could do. Not as effectively. That's one of the things I love about this art form. It's that you and I could go and look at a painting together and we can have a conversation about it. But there's a difference between you and I picking up a paintbrush or our own paintbrushes together and painting something together. And that to me is what games allow us to do. And that's especially what Death Stranding at that time, i.e. COVID, allowed us to do. And I was just like, okay, that's fucking cool. And even though Kojima is in the spotlight of all these obnoxious shots, and even though he probably approved all these obnoxious shots, end of the day, though, he does come off like an interesting fellow. I wish they would have gotten more into, he talked about his father one line. He says, my dad was a real scary guy. And if he were alive, he probably would not have approved of me going into video games. I'm like, okay, well, that's, you know, if I'm making a fucking documentary or doing an interview, I want to know how is he scary? And talk to me about ways that you consciously knew and ways that you only discovered after the fact that influence of your scary dad has affected your video games. You know, there's got to be something there in the cloning and the young Snake and the big boss Snake and the old Snake, you know, and who's the Colonel in Metal Gear, all of that. There's father issues there that influence it, or maybe something in Death Stranding about connection. Yes, it's about connecting the world, but maybe it's just connecting these two people in his heart. You know, I don't know, it's flowery and maybe it's bullshit, but you don't drop a bomb like, my dad was a scary man who wouldn't have approved of me. And then you just let it sit there. But this documentary does. But it makes me curious about Kojima's motivations. He also talks about his parents being in the war. I'm not sure what specific the age is, but I know he talks about bombings, air raids. I know from my ex-wife's mom, who was Japanese and lived during the air raids, the firebombs, and the nukes of World War II, what a traumatic experience. And even though Kojima didn't live through it, I want to know how, more than what he talked about, which was a little bit more than the scary dad line. But that's a nutrition-packed little chunk that should have been mined for information and interesting stories and explanations for why he did what he did in his work. It's almost like they want their cake, but they don't want to have to bake the cake. That's terrible, Jeffy. Never say that again. You know what I'm saying? It's like they want to present this man in connection their documentary as some kind of presentation of this amazing artist that has done important work, yet they don't seem to care about actually discussing much of any of the important work. And what does it mean? And where does it come from? And why is it important? Like I said earlier. But again, that's the documentary's fault. It made him much more interesting. It made the game Death Stranding much more interesting. And I walked away as a bigger fan than I have been. And I was already a fan. And I'm very excited, like I said, to go back and play Death Stranding and give it another try. There were things in the documentary that made me have some questions I wish they would have asked more. He talks about his love of indie movies. And then he cites like David Lynch and David Cronenberg. But he says, I want to make mainstream things. And I'm like, well, those two things don't match. David Lynch does not make mainstream movies, and certainly Cronenberg doesn't. So I'm curious. I would love somebody to go to him and say, you know, even though I know this documentary was shot over a year ago, in light of the conversation or the press release of, I guess it was Herman Holst and Kojima announcing their new spy game. And it was clear they made it a point to talk about action in the game, and it's a return to Metal Gear style gaming and all that. It's clear that most people look at Death Stranding, and as much as you love it or hate it, or you're ambivalent, or you don't even think about it, it didn't hit the zeitgeist the way people wanted it to and expected it to. So I want to know about that. I want to know what his feelings are on that. It's like, you want to be artistic, you want to bring these messages to the world, you want to say something in your games, but what do you do as a creator when, yeah, you're doing that, but people aren't showing up? For them, for enough people it's successful, you got to make a sequel, but for a much larger group of people that might benefit from these messages or these ideas you're putting across, are you going to change the way you work in the future in order to make that message? Like, what's more important, your vision or your ability for that vision to connect with an audience bigger than you've connected with before? That's what an obvious question. It didn't get asked. It didn't get touched on, which was annoying. There's a little something, and this is not to blame Kojima, but there is just, you know, this, I watched this on the day that Sony laid off 900 people. They closed the London studios. It's the second month of the year. There's already been like 9,000 employees in the games business laid off in 2 months. There's something vulgar about watching all of these famous, well-paid actors and musicians, and just the vulgarity of expense when it comes to making a game like this. It clearly is born out of his love of movies, and that's fine and that's great, but to not press on the, why does the production have to be so expensive? Why does it have to be so risky? Can't you express these ideas in a different way, because when you're expressing them at this level, no matter how good it looks, you know, you're not gonna get your message to as many people with a walking simulator, whether it looks like a super low budget indie game or Death Stranding. I want to know that. The last thing I'll say that I was curious about, but I loved, and I wish they would have asked him, Grimes, the musician, I'm not going to quote her, but I'll paraphrase her. She says, there's something about his games that brings you into that uncanny valley between comedy and earnestness. And you want to kind of ask, is this a joke? And she's talking about it in the part of the documentary where a lot of the people are like, we don't really understand what this is in terms of Death Stranding. And, you know, it's presented, as you would imagine by now listening to this, it's presented as a only he can really understand it right now. We're just showing up and it's like, just say yes to this guy. He's a genius. We can't pretend to know what he's thinking, but it's really fucking good, right? And okay, fine. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not, maybe it's 50-50, which is more likely. But there is something about his stuff that I would love to ask that. I wish that were asked. It's like, how much of this is you believing all of this insane, crazy shit you put in your games? And how much of it is, I think it's cool and I like it, but I also know it's preposterously stupid in parts. And I don't mean stupid like it's bad, but just like so absurdly ridiculous in parts of all of his games. And that's, not only is it his style, but here's the reason for that. Here's what he's trying to convey with that. I would love to know that. Why wasn't that asked? I thought it was kind of shitty that they, you know, even Herman Hulse, who should know better, is like, before Kojima, all games were about combat. No one, you know, Kojima basically brought stealth to gaming. And it's like, no, he didn't. There were plenty of other stealth games before Kojima. Did he popularize it amongst, you know, core gamers? Absolutely. But, you know, come on, let's lay back on the lies, if you would. I struggled to get through this documentary. Like I said, I liked what it was about. I loved the fact that it reignited my interest, or really for the first time gave me a great interest in Death Stranding. Super excited for that. Kojima comes off as great, but it was a terrible, it should be ashamed of itself to call itself a documentary. It is a puff piece. It is marketing, and that's fine. But shame on you, Sony, or whoever packaged this as it is. Because just imagine people watching this who don't know any better. And then going into going into a studio like I did when I first worked on Mickey Mania. Like, the director has arrived, everybody. Here, Traveler's Tales, let me tell you exactly what to do and how to do it. I don't really care about your talent. You're just there to make, you know, you're a short order cook. Here's my order. Make it good and fix what I don't like. I mean, that's the message of what it means to be a game director. And we saw it in some of these other documentaries Sony worked on. I think it's a bad look. And I think it's really unfortunate for people who buy this and don't know any better. But Kojima comes off great. The game I'm excited to get back into. I'm much more excited for Death Stranding 2 now. So, you know, end of the day, mission accomplished. As a documentary, it's crap. I would say out of scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best documentary ever made, this is like a 2.5. They touch on things that make you go, ooh, this could be, and then they don't cover it. So at least they, you know, let somebody else in the future who might make a documentary go, hey, I'm going to ask why his work's important, or I'm going to tell the audience why his work is important. Why is his work any more important, or why is his work more influential than the guys who made Fortnite, or the guys who made, or the girls who made the first browser game? I'm not saying it's not, but you don't plant that flag without some fucking details, fellas. I'm curious, if you've watched it, hit me up in the comments. Let me know what you think. Because maybe I'm an outlier. Maybe everybody just fucking loves this fucking thing. Right now, it's sitting, I think, if you go over to IMDb, it's sitting at a 7. Let's see, Rotten Tomatoes is giving this at the moment. There are no critical reviews of this. Okay, let's do Metacritic and see. Oh, well, Kotaku doesn't like it. The Kojima documentary is the worst kind of fan service. Okay, all right. Yeah, look at this. Premiered at Tribeca, the documentary inflates Kojima's mythology as an untouchable auteur until it totally obscures him. Good. So I wonder what other people think. I'll check into some other reviews. That's interesting that I agree with Kotaku. Escapist agreed as well. So yeah, maybe this got just butchered, but I never really heard what people thought about it. But it's out now. You can judge for yourself. But let me know what you think. There's my review. 2.5 out of 10. Well, I think right about now it's a good time to open up the members' mailbag. Thank you guys for all the questions. There wasn't a dud in them. They were all really good, and I will get to all of them as we move through episodes. However, today I'm going to pick three. If you want to send in a question, there will be a room in the Discord specifically where you can put that. And I'll probably put out community posts from time to time as well, like we did the other day. But for today, there are three questions I'm going to get to. And the first one comes from our good pal, Alex S. Here's what he says. He says, Jaffe, which game do you think has the potential to be game of the year for this year? Even if we assume you haven't played it yet, which is probable. Well, game of the year is a goofy little concept because it really is a personal choice, right? But if you're talking about one of the big shows or which game do I think is going to be the most nominated and most rewarded, yeah, I can give you my thoughts on that. What I did to answer this is if you go over to, a lot of sites have this, this is from Polygon, they list all the games that we know of that are coming this year. So I would like to think there'll be some surprises that we don't even know about yet. But when you're talking about game of the year categories and what usually gets nominated, You know more than a year in advance that it's coming down the line, but you'll get that weird indie thing. Like I don't think most people knew about Dave the Diver this time last year. They might have, but maybe it was an early access. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's a game that will get on the list that we haven't even heard of that's from the indie space. But here's the main list: big releases and small releases that Polygon knows about. So here's what I got. I got three categories. I've got Sure Things. I've got If the Wind is Blowing the Right Way and all the cards fall, and just, do cards even fall? Let the cards fall where they may. It doesn't matter. If everything goes just right, that's the second category. It could be. And then the third are kind of like really weird but interesting to me suggestions. So obviously, there's no doubt that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, the reviews are insane on that. Right now at Metacritic, if you go there, it's the fifth highest rated game in the series. It is sitting at a 92 on Metacritic. I would be stunned if this doesn't end up becoming a Game of the Year contender and possibly winner in a lot of cases. So I would say Final Fantasy would be there. Haven't played Dragon's Dogma 2, but it seems like it is now its time. I think Dragon's Dogma 1 being the cult hit that a lot of people love and still talk about. We're finally at a large number. People are paying attention to the series. 2 looks amazing. It sounds amazing. I think this is going to be a big, big hit. In a lot of ways, I think it could be bigger than Elden Ring, partially because I don't think Capcom is trying to make a game that is off-putting to a lot of people because of its difficulty and embraced by a lot of people because of its difficulty. I don't know what the philosophy is, but it doesn't sound like they're banging that particular drum in the PR. It seems like this is going to be like a game that anybody can play if you're a core gamer. So, but I would put Dragon's Dogma 2 in there easily. In August, I have, as another sure thing, I have Black Myth Wukong down on the list. Not because that one barely makes it into the sure thing category. The graphics are just gorgeous. It's going to be interesting to see what sort of the, you know, super woke liberal, of which I am one of the super woke liberal people, but those in the media do with this. Because on one hand, it's kind of a feather in your cap to say, hey, I want to celebrate new developers and it's China and they're kind of breaking into the AAA. And on the other hand, you've got all the problems with China and the government and who funds what over there. So, you know, maybe nothing in the gameplay they've shown is like, I've never seen anything like that in my life, but that is becoming less and less of a requirement, it seems, at some of these shows. So, but Black Myth Wukong, I would say, is a probable. It's barely a probable. It's kind of hanging on the edge there. And those would be the sure things. I think the two obvious ones would be Final Fantasy and Dragon's Dogma, maybe with Black Myth coming in under the wire, but certainly Final Fantasy and Dogma. If you want to talk about the ones where If the Wind Blows in Just the Right Way, I would say the first one we have coming up this year would be, I can never say this title, Senua's Saga Hellblade 2. I don't know. I haven't played the first one, but, and I haven't enjoyed any of their promotions for this game because it's just a bunch of bloviating, pontificating, obnoxious, look how special we are interviews. I need to see the game. But based on what the game is about and based on the fact that it's been in development for a long time, it's a sequel to a beloved game that does have something to say important about mental health, and the way they do it apparently is really successful and really impressive and effective. If the game is able to be what they promise in these obnoxious behind the scenes videos, then I would say this could very easily see itself as a game of the year contender, which would be amazing, because when is the last time, if ever, in the last 10 years anyway, has Microsoft had a game of the year contender? I'm sure they have, but maybe they haven't. I don't know. So I would say, though, this is the first one. It's like, if the winds blow in the right way, Hellblade 2. You know, I had Elden Ring, Shatter the Erdtree DLC. It's not, I'm going to take that off. I'm going to say I don't see that happening, not because it's DLC. I think there will be a day where we see DLC where it's like, holy cow, that can be in the conversation for Game of the Year. But I think from what I've seen of this, it looks big, it looks cool, it's exciting. Of course, I will be playing it, but it is very much more of Elden Ring, which is exactly what they should be giving us. So I'm gonna remove this one. Stalker 2 Heart of Chernobyl. It's not Chernobyl. That was Chernobyl, but it's how you spell Chernobyl. I don't care. The point is Stalker 2. This is on the list because of the way it was made. If the game is really good, it doesn't have to be an actual Game of the Year contender. It doesn't have to be a 92, a 95 Metacritic. But if the game is like an 85, the very nature of it being made, a really good, great game being made and being successful during a war, and that the developer lost members of the team to that war, that were killed in that war, I think it becomes kind of a really hard thing not to celebrate. I mean, again, because when you got to understand, when these people vote, it's not literal as often as I wish it was, which would be 100% of the time, where it's like, this is the best game of the year. A lot of times it's performative. It's like, we want to shine a light on why this is special. And in that, if the game is good enough that it's not like, why in the world, you know, it's like, we appreciate what you're saying, give it a special award, but why in the world would Stalker 2 be in the conversation? Assuming the game is good enough to not be in that category or that descriptor, then I could see this easily being in the nominees. Avowed is on here only because it could go either way. When you hear them talk about it, the level of freedom, the level of customization, the level of really building your own adventure, it sounds pretty impressive. If they pull that off, even though the visuals of the game aren't going to blow your mind and the animations look a little janky, I think it sounds like a great deal of fun at worst, and at best, it could be the Starfield or the next Skyrim that everybody's been waiting for that Starfield didn't deliver. So maybe on Avowed. And then I've got Star Wars Outlaws. Probably not. When is Ubisoft? It's been over a decade since this is just more of their formula. I think, I don't even know if any of their big formula games, you know, certainly the first Assassin's Creed, maybe Assassin's Creed 2, but after that, when's the last time they got a nomination, let alone a win? But, you know, maybe, because everybody's been wanting GTA Star Wars forever, and if they actually pull it off, and it feels more like GTA Star Wars and less like Far Cry Star Wars, which still sounds great, possibly. I could see Star Wars up there. Plucky Squire looks awesome, but, you know, first off, it's not the first game to do the flat 3D thing. I mean, Zelda Link Between Worlds was the first one I remember, but it still looks great. It looks like a lot of fun. If it carries through with that beyond just sort of the gimmick of the 2D, 3D thing, I could see this potentially being nominated, because if you have that really creative, interesting, inspiring, clever, cute vibe that is not just in the trailer, but it really permeates the entire game, then I could see Plucky Squire there. And Visions of Mana, I think, is one of those kind of fan favorite things. I think nothing they've shown makes you think it's anything other than, oh my God, I can't wait to go back into this world, and they're making it 3D, and it looks like a solid, fun action RPG. But Maybe if it's really good, but not astoundingly good, it'll kind of at least get nominated because of the good faith. I doubt that one, but these are the ones I think if everything goes exactly right Visions of Mana, Plucky Squire, Star Wars Outlaws, Avowed, Stalker 2, Heart of whatever, Chernobyl, Elden Ring, no, I moved that one off, and then Hellblade 2. Now, the ones that are really, I don't think, have a chance in hell, but I'd love to see Indiana Jones, because I love Indiana Jones, but come on. I mean, the only way, I mean, this could win maybe if, or this could be nominated maybe if it actually is like, oh my God, this is the Indiana Jones sequel we've been wanting since Last Crusade, and it really feels like an Indiana Jones movie, and it's just like, what the fuck, you know? Maybe, but I doubt it. But that's kind of wishful thinking. 90% of it's wishful thinking. 10% of it is, maybe they could do it. Silent Hill 2 Remake, I don't have any expectation this will be up there. I only put it up there because wouldn't that be a heck of a story if Team Bloober Team, whatever they're called, proved all of us wrong, including me. And they didn't only make a great Silent Hill 2, but it really was kind of the benchmark, the new benchmark of video game horror. I mean, it would be a great story. Come on. I mean, there ain't no way. But it's, you know, anything's possible. Maybe we'll get into an alternate timeline and something will happen. But I doubt it, but that would be another wild card. So there you go, Alex S. Based on nothing but just gut and what I've seen, which impacts the gut, I suppose, those would be the Game of the Year nominees that I think will be part of the conversation, and a lot of those will be nominated, but it's all a guess, man. One of our new members, Nate Montgomery, writes in. He says, Jaffy, what is your earliest, happiest childhood memory? I will show you what it is, actually. Here you go. I was born in 1971. This is a toy that came out in 1975. I remember having a Batman-themed birthday party. I was 4 years old. I just have flashes of recollection. And what I remember the most is my dad pulling this Batman Batcycle toy that I'll show you right now on the screen off the back of his truck, and getting this and riding around in it. You know, I had a lot, and I have a lot of happy memories, and I had a lot of happy events occur in my childhood. It was a good childhood. Like everybody else's, it had its ups and downs, and it's crazy, and it's trauma. But the good outweighs the bad, and this is certainly the top of my head, and there's obviously no way to know for sure. This is certainly one of my earliest, happiest childhood memories, is what I would say, is getting this bike and just thinking it was the coolest fucking thing in town. Wouldn't that be weird if it actually was the coolest thing in town, just for a moment? Like you could gauge it. It's like suddenly the coolest thing in town was this kid had this toy that wasn't even like a one-off. It was like you could buy it anywhere. So dumb. Final question of the day comes from our very own Addy Pie. He says, what helped you recover after finishing working on a project? I'm assuming you would have been extremely exhausted, as most creatives are. You know, my creative work was so from a place of not the creativity, but the motivation was such from a place of unhealth or poor mental health, I should say, that it wasn't as if I could kind of go, that was a job well done. Now I'm going to turn it off and I'm going to go off and just lose myself to a beach in Hawaii. My doing creative work really came out of a need to have a level of success and adulation and validation. And so even though I completed a project and I went through the motions of like, oh, now here's what I'm supposed to do. Now I'm supposed to go take a break and really just kind of forget everything. And I remember after God of War, my wife at the time and I, we went away to we stayed in LA because we had the kids, but we went away to a like beach house that we rented for a while, and I bought a guitar because I was going to learn to play guitar. And Sony was very generous, and I took, you know, it was like 4 months off paid before I had to get back to work to just recuperate. And I had this, you know, very normal expectation that I was going to recharge, and I was going to forget all about games, and I was going to read, and I, you know, all the healthy shit that you're supposed to do. But the very nature of being in a position that allowed me to be successful enough with the teams I worked with to be granted such a amount of leisure time that I was still getting paid for, was the very thing, the unhealthy mindset that never allowed me to shut it off when I was chasing that particular rabbit. So I went through the motions of relaxing and letting go, and I certainly let go of the property God of War. Like I that part worked. Like I was able to easily say goodbye to Kratos and all that, but the idea, I was immediately thinking about what's next and what is my next career move and what is the next game I want to do, and let me play all the games that are hitting so I can make sure I understand where the competition is. And I was never able to shut it off, ever. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't really have hobbies other than, you know, hanging with the family. I love what I did then when I was doing it, and I love what I do now. So if I have free time, I don't want to go make a model. I know it's healthy. I know I probably should, but I don't want to. I don't want to, you know, learn to play guitar. I mean, I'd love to be able to play guitar, but if I have a choice between learning to play it and editing a video to work on the channel, I'd rather edit a video to work on the channel. I've just always been that way. And as much as I appreciate the mental health value of being another way as it relates to the subject, it's just never really been my thing. So at first, when I started answering this question, I was like, well, it's because of an unhealthy relationship with the creative process. And I'm sure that was part of it. And I can certainly relax more during doing this work than I did doing that work. But I think there's also a part of it that's just like, I've been real fortunate that I get to do the work. I get paid for the work that I would want to do for free anyway. And so, and I know everyone's not that fortunate, but when you can make your hobby your career, there are some bad things that come with that. I assume people tell me there are. I haven't discovered enough of them to stop. But when you can do it, why would you want to not work on your hobby as often as you can? So that's what I would say. Fellas, that's wrapping up. My brain is leaking. I was going to do some more bad day game stories. I'll save those for next week or the week after. Let me know again in the chat. This will be the first one that we lock behind the members' Patreon and YouTube. Let me know if you like this series, if I should continue it, if it gives value to your membership. I'll lock it behind the paywall until, you know, 1 to 3 weeks, like a lot of people do. But the first week, at least, maybe the first 2 weeks, this is going to be just for members. So I'm very curious if you feel it brings anything to your life. Is it important work like Kojima? Wink. And of course, be sure to check out Day One Patch Kids. You see them over there on the left. They are Garbage Pail Kids meet video games. They're wonderful stickers, mugs, t-shirts, all kinds of great stuff over there from our very own Rotten Tanuki. Alex Plox, who did our intro music, does a lot of great music on the internet. All of this is in the link tree below. Three Daddy Podcast as well. In fact, I was on their show recently. Check me out on the Three Daddy Podcast on YouTube. It was a lot of fun. It was like kind of a raw, vulgar version of Last Stand Media's Constellations. And then Alex Plox, here he is again as we head off into the sunset with Twisted Metal, Quake Zone Rumble, done in a more synthy kind of way. Be well, my friends.